I'm Tom. I'm a criminal defense attorney.
And I'm Chris, and I'm his sister. And this
is Room for Innocence.
So I was asking some questions on Facebook to people, just kind of getting ideas for the podcast, general questions like, you know, who are some alleged criminals or even convicted criminals or whatever that you don't think you could defend in a court of law? And got a lot of the usual Casey Anthony, you know, or
that Casey Anthony's, you know, that makes sense. You know, they're saying she killed her kid, so that's tough.
Yeah. And one person responded, anybody who hurts children. I could not defend anybody who hurts children.
And that's fair.
That's not why we chose this week's episode, but it's kind of relevant because this week's episode is about harming children and the defense of the person who may or may not have been responsible.
True. And we've talked about jury selection before. You get the panel of potential jurors, you ask them questions, you come up with an unbiased jury. And the judge reads the charges out. And with the sex cases, you get the reactions right away. People just are right away. They're just like, I can't be on this case. You don't even have to start talking about it. People go crazy when they hear about the kids. So cases like this are very important to people.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think one thing that might be interesting is that this is from our time somewhat, because this is the 70s. And even though I'm only 25, you know, I remember the 70s, and I remember this was the before time. This is when this is the time when people joke about it. We come home when the lights come on, things like that.
Right.
This is back when things were still fun.
Absolutely. Yeah. Did you watch any of the Johnny Cash movie? The reason I asked is because in the Johnny Cash one, he starts out being like, it was a time when puppies were puppies and kittens were kittens. And I'm just like, oh, Johnny.
Dang it. I don't want to hear about your puppies. I love Johnny Cash.
I know you do. That's why I was telling you there's this.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, okay. So I guess for our listeners, let's set the stage a little bit.
All right, guys, listen up.
There's this movie out on Hulu right now called Keeper of the Ashes about these Girl Scout murders in 1977. Kristen Chenoweth plays a role in this. And it's like, she was a Girl Scout and she lived in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, where these girls were from. And she literally says, coulda, woulda, shoulda been on that trip.
Yeah.
But she wasn't.
She wasn't.
She wasn't there.
I'd never seen her before. Okay. I wasn't familiar with her. Apparently she's somebody, but I started watching it as I wanted to learn about it. I was like, great. 3 episodes. Perfect. And I could just tell instantly, like right away, I could tell that this was going to be about her journey back home. And this was going to be kind of about her. And I think I got 5 minutes into it. And it was another scene of her walking through the woods, talking about coming back home to investigate. And I think that's when I lost it, because I'm like, this woman's not investigating anything. And the Johnny Cash thing, while I'm throwing it out there, I'm just going to say, like, you know, he started waxing poetic in the beginning. And I was like, that's not what I'm here for. I'm here for facts, you know?
Yeah. So the Johnny Cash movie that we're talking about is called Someone Cry for the Children. It's based off of a book by the same name. The movie is available on YouTube. If you watch, the order I watched them in is I watched Keeper of the Ashes first, and then I watched Someone Cry for the Children. And it's the same cast of characters, obviously. And in the Johnny Cash movie, they're maybe 30 years younger. And so it's very interesting to see the parents of the children 30 years younger, all of the authorities 30 years younger.
Did you learn anything new from watching both of these, or was it just the same stuff?
Yeah, it's like a different, it's a different perspective because more time has passed. And so things just sound a little different after 30 extra years of reflection and review. I think they're both good movies. Kristen Chenoweth did not ruin Keeper of the Ashes, but she tried.
She tried. Oh man.
And it's still very good. It's still worth watching, but the comments from people on social media are funny. Like, I don't need another scene of her blonde ponytail blowing in the wind. Or her singing, there's all, because she's a singer, and there's all these scenes of her singing, and I thought I was going to lose it.
Oh, I couldn't. Well, let me just tell you this right now, Chris. You know that I would not have, that would have been it for me. I did not make it to the singing.
Nothing has ever ruined a program for you, like when somebody starts to sing.
That's the end of that.
I remember my senior year of college, it was graduation weekend or something, and you and mom and dad came up to the college to spend the weekend with me, and we went to see Guys and Dolls.
I remember that. It was really good, is my what my memory's telling me.
That's my recollection, is that you sat down in your seat, and as soon as they started to sing the first song, you just, I don't know, like your feet shot out, like you're like, you just went like 3 inches lower in your seat, and you looked at me and you were like, how long is this going to be?
Oh, I was being a dick. I must have just been being a... I remember enjoying it. So I guess that's the funny secret.
Well, that's good. Okay. Have I started telling the story yet? Okay, let's just start. On June 13th, 1977, three Girl Scouts were murdered and sexually assaulted in the early morning hours at Camp Scott in Locust Grove, Oklahoma, about an hour's drive east of Tulsa. The three victims were 8-year-old Lori Farmer, 9-year-old Michelle Gousset, and 10-year-old Denise Milner. They were all
young.
Oh, yes.
Sorry. Yeah, I just kind of jumped. I just jumped out there. But I mean, I mean, you know, 8, 10 for what
sexual
happened.
Sexual assault and murder.
I just can't believe it. Anyway, go on.
Yeah. So you think of two things that come to mind right away is, like, first of all, the person who did this, like, let me go into a Girl Scout camp and murder some children who are just easy prey. They're alone in their tents without adults. Let's just go in there in the middle of the night and murder some children. It's just so hard to conceive of the type of monster that would do this. And then the other thing that immediately comes to mind for me is the parents who dropped these girls off at camp. It was the first night of camp. And the parents get a call the next morning that their children have been killed. And one of the awful things is one of the parents, Sherry Farmer, the mom of Lori, said she was informed that her daughter was killed in an accident, and she learned on television that her daughter had been murdered.
Wow. Oh, that's not right. That's really bad. Yeah. And I couldn't imagine. It went through my mind, you know, because I'm a parent. I have two children. And, you know, and we always worry about our kids. We worry about our kids all the time. And you just have to let them do. There comes a point when you got to let the bird fly out of the nest. For example, my daughter is 16, and right now she is she's traveling right now at something called Space Camp. So she's going off to I think it's Huntsville, Alabama, where there's like a mission control center, and she's spending an entire week with other students doing space camp, where they just do all this crazy stuff. This is not a plug for space camp. So, but she had to get on a plane and go fly from Jacksonville to Atlanta and then Atlanta to Alabama, and just have to let her go. You know, I mean, it's just comes a point where you have to kind of step back and let your children do these things. And the whole point that I'm trying to make is, as a parent, you have to let go, and you can't just sit here and assume that all the terrible things that might happen are going to happen. You know, so what parent in their right mind would be like, oh, I'd let her go on that Girl Scout trip, but whoa, there might be an axe murderer.
Right.
And then it happens, and it freaking happens. Back to you, Chris.
Had she ever been on a plane before?
Yes, with groups of other people a couple of times.
Oh, that's right. Because she came up to Washington, D.C. That's yes. right. Okay.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, the middle of the woods, these camping, you know, these tents and everything, it does kind of, like, if I went there, I would totally be thinking there could be an axe murderer in the woods, because that's like what I think when I go into a dark, scary place in the middle of the wilderness. Okay. So all three of these girls were from Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, which is a suburb of Tulsa. And in case you missed it, it's also where Kristen Chenoweth is from. And she coulda, woulda, shoulda been on this trip. So if you think about how messed up she says she is, because she could have been on this trip, think about the other girls that were on this trip.
The girls who actually went on this trip? Yes. Oh, my God.
To be that close to something. Yeah. Lori Michelle and Denise were in tent 8 of the Kiowa unit, which was the most isolated tent in the camp and farthest away from the counselor's tent. So this was their first night at camp. During the night, one of the counselors, Carla, she was awakened in the middle of the night by an intermittent noise that she said was a low and guttural sound like an animal. So she goes out of her tent and she grabs her flashlight and she walks around and she's shining her flashlight around. And as she would kind of swing her flashlight around, the sound would stop. And then she would turn to walk back towards the tent and she would stop and she would hear the sound start again. And she would swing her light around and it would stop. And this was undoubtedly the killer with these girls in the woods. And she thought it was an animal. And so she was thinking to herself, well, I'm not going to stay here and provoke this animal anymore. It's going to come charging out of the woods at me and I don't have any idea what it is. So,
well, we're just sitting here talking about it. Think about how scared she was, though.
And terrified.
This, like, even just now.
Because she thinks it's an animal. And she's like, I'm not going to provoke this anymore. By the way, she's probably 16 years old because she's a camp counselor. You know, so she's a teenager herself. But it's amazing how much she does the right thing. She wakes another counselor to say, like, do you hear that? You know, what do you think? So she doesn't just think about it on her own. And then she walks to all of the tents in the Kiowa unit and just walks around just to check. She doesn't go in them, obviously.
Well, good for her. That's pretty good thinking. Yeah.
But she walks all around before she goes back to her tents and goes back to sleep. At 6 o'clock, her alarm goes off. She wanted to get up early and hit the showers before the warm water ran out. So she gets up early. She's walking up the trail to the showers. And out of the corner of her eye, she sees what looks like a pile of sleeping bags. And when she tells the story, she starts breaking up because she's talking about all the things that she's telling herself in her mind that this could be other than what she was actually seeing. But she walks over to them and she sees a little girl laying there. And it was Denise Milner and she was dead. She tells the camp director and it soon becomes clear that the other two girls from Denise's tent were also missing. And when the camp director looks inside the sleeping bag, they can see that the other two girls' bodies are inside those sleeping bags. You know, what they believe happened is that the other two girls, Lori and Michelle, were killed inside the tent. And then the killer put their bodies into the bags and carried them like sacks, like Santa.
That is seriously, literally like slasher film type stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Horrifying. Like it's just everything's bad about this.
It's so awful. And their bodies were, you know, all at the end of the bag because he had carried them like that. And the investigators just said they're just so tiny. He's like, you don't think about how tiny an 8-year old is until you see what tiny portion of the bag this little person filled up.
Wow, that's a very intense visual.
Yes. Yeah,
just they just take up that little bit
of the bag,
and there's
to the point where they didn't realize there were bodies in the bags at first. That's how little they are. And then it was like, where are the girls, you know? So it was quickly determined that Lori and Michelle had been bludgeoned to death. And again, they think that happened in the tent because of blood spatter and and things of that nature. And then Denise, they believe he dragged her into the woods and strangled her near where the bodies were found. And all three girls were sexually assaulted. A couple of like forensic things, I guess. A large red flashlight was found on top of the bodies, and there was a fingerprint on the lens. And the flashlight had some newspaper and tape on it. A roll of duct tape and some nylon rope was found near the bodies. And then a really weird thing, the killer had taken prescription glasses from other tents around the camp, and those were found near the bodies. They said it was like the killer needed new glasses and was like trying to find ones that were a fitting prescription or something, because there were several pairs of glasses that had been stolen from other campers that were near the bodies. Bizarre.
Yes, that is an odd detail.
A suspect was quickly identified. A local football hero, 33-year-old Jean Leroy Hart, had grown up in the area and was a member of the Cherokee Nation. Hart was an escaped convict. He had been sentenced to 105 to 308 years at the Oklahoma State Penitentiary.
That's a long time.
Following convictions for kidnapping, rape, and first-degree burglary.
Well, he did it then.
Yeah, I mean, he's a bad guy. So he did. Oh, well, oh, and it gets worse. So he's in the county jail. I think he had been convicted and, you know, was in the jail pending going to the prison. And he escaped in 1973, 4 years before the murders. He escaped from jail. And he had been at large ever since. So the sheriff knew who he was, didn't like him, and he had embarrassed the sheriff by escaping from his jail.
Well, let me ask this. Maybe you're answering this question as I'm thinking of it. How did they identify him as a suspect?
Here's my next sentence. It's not clear to me exactly how Hart was made a suspect.
Okay.
Other than the fact that the sheriff pointed to him as the likely suspect, since he was a convicted rapist who was an escaped convict. Based on everything I saw, it was just kind of like, oh, people were raped and murdered. There's an escaped convict who was a rapist. It had to be him.
What do they have besides that? Because they definitely need more than that.
At this point, nothing. It was disclosed at a preliminary hearing in June of 1978, so a year after the murders, that the authorities had no evidence beyond their suspicion that linked Mr. Hart to the killings when the charges against him were filed by the Mays County District Attorney, Sidney Wise. So they filed charges with no evidence.
So was this a media frenzy case back then? Like in the set, like, is it, and I'm asking because is this just one of these cases where you're like, oh, we've got to get somebody.
For context, most of the articles that I read about this were from that time period in the New York Times. So the New York Times was covering this regularly.
Okay. Yeah.
So yeah, it was huge.
Yeah.
Right. So they, at that point, they had no evidence. They filed these charges. They believed that it was Hart, and then they proceeded to collect evidence to support the theory that Hart had done this. In searching some caves around the area, they found a cave, and this cave looked like it had been recently inhabited. It had some little fires that had been burned around it, which they felt looked like a Native American ritual. And there were these photographs of a couple of women. And the photographs were shared to the media to hopefully lead authorities to the killer. You know, does anybody recognize these photographs? Somebody did recognize the photographs. These pictures had been taken by a prison officer who moonlighted as a wedding photographer. And these photos had been developed by Jean Leroy Hart, their prime suspect. Not only did they find these photographs in the cave, they also found newspaper that matched the newspaper on the flashlight, as well as one of the pairs of stolen glasses from the camp. To play the defense side of this, it feels really perfect that it's like, we found something that ties to the camp and we found something that ties to Hart. He did it.
Absolutely. If I was on the defense, I'd be trying to figure out a way to say that, because you have to be careful when you say things like that to the jury.
Yeah.
What ends up happening with all this evidence against this guy?
In the first few days after the murders, it seemed clear cut. The authorities were saying Jean Leroy Hart was their suspect. They were finding these pieces of evidence that supported it. They had found a bloody footprint inside the tent. And it felt like things were really progressing and they were going to find their guy. And then there were also some questions about whether one man acting alone could have even committed this crime, because two girls were killed in the tent. One was killed out in the woods. Did he make three trips? How did he do that without, you know, the third girl, which was Denise, without Denise screaming or something? And just the way the bodies were piled, Denise was on top. So you kind of knew that she was the last one. And it just didn't really match a single killer. So by this time, there's a massive manhunt underway to apprehend Hart. And he was on the run for 10 months after the murders. In April of 1978, Jean Leroy Hart was captured after an informer led the police to the cabin of a Cherokee medicine man named Sam Pigeon. And Hart had been hiding in that cabin for 3 months.
Right.
But the community really rallied around Hart.
When you say the community, I mean, I guess if we made that clear, like this is, if I'm correct, like, isn't there like a very, very heavy, indigenous population here?
Yeah, it is about 50% Native Americans. So absolutely. And it seemed Native American and non-Native alike were rallying around Hart. He had been this local football hero, and all you have all of these people saying he could never have done this. Keep in mind, this man was a convicted rapist who had raped two women, bound them, and left them to die. He had covered their mouths and noses when he left them in the middle of the woods. And he had...
That's tough. Wrapping them up and leaving them to die in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
So for the whole community to say there's no way he could have done this was... a little bit. That didn't really add up either. He had escaped from jail 3 years earlier and people were housing him. People were keeping him safe and, you know, keeping him under the radar. So, you know, he really had a strong support network. Local fundraising efforts were held to cover the estimated attorney fees of $35,000. And in the documentaries, family members of the Girl Scouts were saying that when they entered the courtroom, they felt like the ones on trial. They said when they were out and about in the community, there were collection jars all around to support Hart's defense. Lori Farmer's dad said that they would have liked to change a venue to a place more neutral, but that is not a right afforded to the prosecution, only to the defense. So it's super interesting that you have this community of like half white, half Native supporting him so strongly.
That is very interesting.
Especially that he's, you know, an escaped felon.
That and rape and with a child sort of case. These are the sort of cases where people are not looking to get behind people charged with crimes like this.
So right. Who could have hurt these little girls. Yeah. Yeah. Really interesting. Okay. So we come to pretrial and the prosecutor is this Mays County District Attorney Sidney Wise, the one who filed charges before there was any evidence. Hart's lawyers are his principal attorney, Garvin Isaacs, and second chair, Gary Pitchlin. And the pretrial hearings begin in June of 1978, a year after the murders. The prosecution laid out its case, and the evidence presented at the hearing was highly technical and circumstantial. They didn't have much on Hart, except that hair and semen from the scene could be a match, but it wasn't conclusive. They had physical evidence, such as the photos from the cave and the newspaper, but it was speculated that this physical evidence could have been planted by the authorities.
Okay, very interesting. Speculated by the defense somehow in their questioning, or?
It's a good question about how we know that at this point, because this is the pre-trial hearings, and I don't think they had formally said, I don't think the defense team had formally said that they believed evidence was planted, but quote unquote, sources close to the defense were saying that. And there was a lot of New York Times coverage, and there were several mentions of potentially planted evidence. So it was definitely something that people were whispering about, although I don't think it had been stated yet in a courtroom.
I mean, it's certainly something that has happened.
But here's something that did not work out very well for him.
For Hart.
For Hart. In the pretrial, the defense called a jailhouse snitch, Jimmy Don Bunch.
Liar. And
Jimmy Don, for the defense called him.
Oh, never mind. All right, jailhouse snitch. Okay. I just heard snitch. All right.
I know. So Jimmy Don was expected to testify that prosecutors had offered him parole if he would implicate Hart. So that was going to be good for the defense. But instead, Jimmy Don testified that when he asked Hart if he had done it, quote, he dropped his head and said, I don't know. I had been smoking reefer and drinking wine for 3 days. I woke up in a cave and had blood all over me. Wah, wah.
Wah, wah. Oh, no. Why'd you say that?
Now, granted, this is just pretrial, you know, but at that point, I think the state had probable cause to move forward.
I guess so, but oh, yeah, I was smoking weed again, and I went and killed everybody. It never happened, ever. Listen, I've done a million cases. I've never seen anybody hurt anybody or steal anything for weed. I've seen people do some weird shit for crack.
Yeah.
But I've never had a case where somebody's done anything for weed, even if they drank a little wine. I guarantee you they just fell asleep.
Mm-hmm. I smoked some weed and I accidentally killed some Girl Scouts and
hung his head below his knees and said, oh, I was smoking the weed and I had some wine and
no, I don't know.
And then I killed everybody. Okay.
So things are going to move forward. They're going to go to trial. In November of 1978. Okay. So the pretrial hearings were in June of 1978. In November of 1978, the prosecutor, Sid Wise, withdrew from the case and was replaced by a DA from Tulsa, S.M. Fallis, the Tulsa County District Attorney.
Why?
Because Wise had signed a contract to be a co-author of a book about the murders and had allowed...
What an idiot.
Right? He had allowed his co-author, a former journalist, to see confidential investigative files on the murders.
Well, I hope he was able to write the book. I mean, did he get disbarred? I mean, like, what happened? I mean, that's, who knows? But like, what a dumbass. Yeah. Sorry.
I don't think he got disbarred. He was saying something like, oh, I thought I was free to share it with anyone that I thought was relevant. And
like my publisher.
Yeah, it was sort of clarified that no, he could not do that, but he withdrew from the case. He offered some cockamamie explanation, like he was feeling pressure from the defense, but it was because of the
like, I don't wish shame on anyone, but that must have sucked for him.
Yeah. Oh, book deal, that sounds great. Here's all my files, man. Like, what a just
it's so easy to start ragging on these guys, but I think a valid point needs to be made, which is a lot of the things that happen in the judicial system happen so people can get publicity and get their names viewed in a certain way so they can get reelected. It's no secret. Judges, state attorneys, not all of them, but there are outside influences that are readily apparent.
Okay, so now we're getting to where things are real. The trial. The trial lasted from March 19th, 1979 to May 30th, 1979. Jury selection was really challenging. They had to examine more than 100 people. They ended up with a jury of six men and six women, all white, mostly blue collar, and the jury would be sequestered for the trial, which was likely to take over a month.
All right.
And I think part of the reason they had so much trouble finding a jury is so many of the prospective jurors just straight up said that they believed in Hart, that they didn't think he did it.
Interesting. I was reading an article that was an interview of Hart. His two attorneys were present. They didn't say much. He spoke. They talked about a little bit about the trial, and they mentioned, I remember the interviewer said, well, how do you feel that there were no Native Americans on jury panel? And he said, I didn't care. Or like, that's not what we were there for. He's like, I just wanted people that were fair and impartial. I think he said, I don't care if they were purple, you know, if they're fair and impartial, I want them on my jury. And I was like, good point. You know, you're not in here to prove a point. You're not in here protesting. You're not in here trying to advance a cause. You're trying to go home not guilty.
Mm-hmm. He was pretty charming. He looked really nice in his suit. He was well-spoken, which leads me to the next point, which is at the very beginning of the trial, Hart's lawyer, Mr. Isaacs, who the New York Times referred to as a young Oklahoma City lawyer who is given to touches of the dramatic. Mr. Isaacs moved to have Mr. Hart named as his own co-counsel so that he could read the opening statement himself to the jury.
Did that happen? Did they do
no.
that?
No.
Okay. What? Never heard that one.
You can he was so kind of easygoing and humble and charming, that is how he
even
came
his
across
attorney's
and,
like, hey man, I think you should do this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the way you say it.
The prosecutor said, I object on the ground that Mr. Hart is not a lawyer and could not be expected to know what is admissible in an opening statement. And District Judge William J. Whistler said, the unusual proposal seemed to be fraught with too many possibilities for error.
That's a reasonable decision. I can totally respect that. You don't want the case to come back. It's stupid. Request to make it the last minute. That's the sort of thing you should make with a motion to be argued with case law, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. I think part of the reason he wanted Hart to give the opening statement, tell me if this is possible. They didn't want Hart to take the stand because of his history. There were too many other things that could be brought up about his previous convictions and whatnot. But perhaps if he was co-counsel and he gave the opening statement, he would have the ability to influence the jury without taking the stand.
Where are you getting this? Did you just come up with that? Or?
Yeah, I just made that.
That. Yeah, I mean, I could, as the prosecutor or whatever, I would be, that would be a huge, huge point that I'd be making, is somehow or another, like, you have testified to the jury, even if mm-hmm. you're just giving your opening statement. You're not testifying, but you're saying what you think the facts are going to show. Like, you're
telling your side of the story.
Your credibility becomes an issue. Therefore, you can be cross-examined and they can bring up your past. Anyway, jury selection, media.
Jury selection's done. They're doing these motions. He had the motion for the co-counsel. Judge said, eh.
Denied.
Judge Whistler also rejected an attempt by Mr. Isaacs to produce testimony from a Kansas psychologist who had given Mr. Hart a battery of tests and had concluded that the defendant was, quote, not of the character that would molest small children.
It's laughable that you would even try to bring that in as evidence.
Why? It's the defense. Why shouldn't he try to bring that in?
I mean, I guess you could try, but you can't get that in.
Because a psychologist couldn't say that you were not the type to.
He ain't the kind of guy to do it. No, I have nothing further to say on the matter. I applaud the defense for trying to bring that in. Good job. But there's no way.
Okay. Much of the state's case depended on expert scientific and forensic testimony. Prosecution experts testified that hair found on the girls belonged to Hart. They couldn't have conclusively said that, but they said that it matched Hart's hair. Like, you look at it under a microscope and they look the same. That's basically what they were getting at.
It sounds like they couldn't exclude it, but they couldn't determine that it was the same hair.
Yes, except that's not really what they said. You know what I mean? That's mm-hmm. what it, that's the truth, but they sort of testified like, yes, it's a match.
Yeah.
And then another expert, Dr. John McLeod, fertility expert at Cornell University, testified that sperm found on the girls' bodies was that of the defendant.
That's pretty good evidence. I mean, I'm saying, like, if you're a jury member and you hear that.
It's just so strange, and because there was this sperm and this guy says it's a match. There's no DNA, right? So it's looking at them under a microscope and being like, yeah, that's his. But yeah, then that's... he had had a vasectomy, so he shouldn't be producing sperm. And so then it was like, oh, well, maybe his vasectomy wasn't 100% effective. And it's just also wishy-washy that this is why the jury's like, you know, what? It just, without DNA back then, it was just, it was really hard to prove these things. All right. So now we're kind of moving on to the defense. Like, that's really all the prosecution has, is there were these objects that were found, you know, the photographs and the tape, the newspaper, and he's this rapist escape convict. And we've got experts that say the hair and DNA look like his.
Okay. That's just weak to me.
It's pretty weak. It's pretty weak. So then the defense goes up. They have another guy did it theory, where they say that it was not Hart that killed the Girl Scouts, but it was a convict named Bill Stevens, who at the time of the trial was back in prison serving time for rape and kidnapping. And apparently a Girl Scout tentatively identified William Stevens as the man lurking outside her tent a few days before the murders. But then the prosecution says the hair found on the bodies of the victims did not match Stevens. So you have Hart, who's a Native American, and the hair matches his, and it doesn't match this guy Stevens, who's not a Native American. I'm just going to pause here for a second because, oh, it's worse on Stevens. Hold on. The defense called several witnesses who claimed to have seen Stevens the morning of the killings, acting nervous, dirty, and with a red stain on his boots.
Well, geez.
But the hair didn't match.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point, I'm thinking multiple killers.
Oh, right, right. Yeah, there's multiple killers, of course.
So let's think about Hart and Stevens. So that's why Hart's, you know, hair that matches Hart is there, but Stevens has the dirty boots and somebody saw him there. So would the prosecution or the defense want to be the ones to raise multiple killers? The defense obviously won't. The defense will say it wasn't Hart, it was Stevens. But if the prosecution says, okay, well, Stevens could have been there, but Hart is who's on trial, does that hurt them? I kind of think it hurts them, because then the jury might be like, it could have just been Stevens.
Yeah, I think it does provide more room for doubt.
Yeah, so the defense is saying this guy Bill Stevens was involved. Prosecutors are like, nope, the hair doesn't match. Okay. In the defense's opening statement, the lawyer, Mr. Isaacs, told the jury that Hart had an alibi. He told the jury that Hart left Mays County for Tulsa, which was about 30 miles away, more than a week before the killings, and returned to his mother's house, which is very close to the camp, 4 days after the killings. So that's what he said in his opening statements, although apparently during the trial, he struggled to provide witness evidence to this fact.
Yeah, that's the thing about these alibis. You really got to back them up with some evidence, like good evidence. Because people are just going to think you're lying.
It's only 30 miles to drive out
Yeah, that's, you know, nothing.
Commit these murders, get back in the car and drive back to Tulsa. Yeah. It's nothing.
No. Yeah. 30, you need to be able to provide your alibi for the exact time when it happened, you know? Yeah. That's not like, you know, you were in a different state or whatever.
Yeah. Across the country. The defense also said, look, all of these objects that law enforcement officers found near the cave were linked with other objects from the scene of the crime, but none of them can be identified as belonging to Hart. They don't have his fingerprints on them. The only thing that links them to Hart is that those photographs were in the same location. It's the only thing.
Those weren't even his though, right?
He had developed them.
So would these be originals that he had kept, or maybe he had negatives, or?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There was apparently a former jailer who said that these photographs were known to have been in the jail after Hart had escaped. So they had a witness that claimed he had seen those photographs since Hart's escape. And that, you know, that makes it look like planted evidence.
People will do anything to get themselves out of trouble. And police are people like anybody else. And this is the kind of case that'll make people do stuff that they normally wouldn't do, like plant evidence.
Yeah. Three tiny little Girl Scouts being murdered. And you've made this point on previous episodes, which is, it's not that the police are trying to send Hart to jail for it so that it's like, we sent somebody to jail, everyone will get off our case. They think it's him. They truly believe that it's him. And so it's possible that they set the stage to prove their case. They don't think they're sending an innocent man to jail. They don't
Right.
think that they're letting a killer go free so that they can send Hart to jail. They think it was him.
Absolutely. And when I say that, what you had just alluded to, certainly not saying that it's okay to do whatever you have to do to get the guilty guy in jail. I mean, you know, I like to think that people follow the evidence and make the right decisions. But yes, these police almost always, I really truly feel like they think they are doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody's trying to be bad.
The evidence points to multiple killers. So it didn't feel like there was an attempt for them to find a group. You know, who would have teamed up to do this? Especially with this Bill Stevens. Oh, well, his hair didn't match. Couldn't have been him. And it's, you know, quite possible that these two did it together.
So anyway, I guess, so where are we now in this trial?
Okay, so the defense is now going to put up their experts. They put up two chemists who dispute the state's evidence. The two witnesses suggest that some of the chemical tests bordered on guesswork. John T. Wilson, chief forensic chemist for the Kansas City Police Department's Regional Crime Laboratory, told jurors that tests conducted on hair, blood, and semen samples taken from Mr. Hart were unreliable. And Herbert Maxey, a chemist who formerly analyzed hair and semen samples for state law enforcement agencies, said the tests could show similarities, but that's about as far as it goes.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So that's it. That's it. Prosecution has presented their case. The defense has presented its side of the story. Hart is not going to take the stand because everything that he's done in his past would be brought to the jury.
And he was not able to give his opening.
Yeah, he statement. Wasn't able to be co-counsel. So the jury is off to deliberate. They have about 4 hours that day to deliberate. And then they pause until the next day. They deliberate for another less than an hour. And then they say they're ready to deliver their verdict. And their verdict was...
dun, dun, dun.
Not guilty.
Not guilty. Yep.
What a surprise. Yeah. And actually, one of the jurors said that when they first went back into the deliberation room and they took a quick vote on guilty, not guilty, it was 12-0, not guilty.
So what'd they take 4 hours doing?
They just went over everything. They wanted to be sure that they had really thought everything through and not missed anything.
Wow. And they went and slept on it and still came up with a not guilty.
Came back, did another 30, 40 minutes of review and said, yeah, we feel really good about this. Not guilty.
So that's 1978, right?
It is 1979. 1979, May 30th of 1979. Okay.
All right.
Shortly thereafter in prison, a couple months later, Gene Leroy Hart is working out in the yard, in the prison yard, and he drops dead of a heart attack. He dropped dead right after going back to prison. Heart attack and died.
He was young too. In the 30s. I mean, not a baby, but he was...
Yeah, 35.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. 35 years old, died of a heart attack.
So then what happens? Did they just close this case? I mean,
yeah. So people asked right away when the not guilty verdict came through, people asked the prosecutors and investigators if they were going to try somebody else. They said, no, we had the right guy. We will never try this again. Lori Farmer's parents asked the sheriff's office to return all of her belongings and all of the evidence that pertained to her, and they gave it all back. So they were done. They were not going to try anyone else.
Okay.
But as we know, DNA advancements occurred over the next 10 to 15 years. So in 1989, some DNA testing was done on some of the evidence, and it showed that 3 of 5 probes matched Hart's DNA. I don't know exactly what probes are, but, you know, there's a partial match.
Right.
And Hart is a member of the Cherokee Nation. And I read that statistically, DNA from 1 in 7,700 Native Americans would obtain these results. So once again, it matches him pretty well, but it's not.
That's pretty common.
Yeah, it's not like we're used to seeing trillions.
Yes. Yeah. When we get like a DNA match, it's in the billions, or at least it's not in the maybe the millions, but it's not in the thousands. That's silly.
Yeah. Not great. In 2008. So that was 1989. Now 2008. So another 20 years later, authorities conducted new DNA testing on stains from a pillowcase, but the results were inconclusive because the samples were too deteriorated. In 2017, $30,000 in donations were raised by the sheriff to do new DNA tests using the latest advances in testing. This new sheriff is in the Keeper of the Ashes movie. And he's great. You know, he's like, he really just wants this solved. And so he raised this $30,000 to do new DNA testing. And the results of that testing have been known since 2019. But Sheriff Mike Reed of Mays County did not go public with the DNA findings until the victims' families asked him to. In 2022. So it was actually just a couple of months ago that authorities made the results public. And it's really not any more enlightening, I think, than where we already were. The DNA evidence strongly suggests that Hart was involved. And when asked to clarify this, I believe what he has said is that they had about 300 potential suspects in this case, and that all of them have been exonerated except for Hart.
Hmm.
That actually kind of reminds me again of the multiple killer theory. There's only one semen provider. So there still could be multiple killers, but I can see where the prosecution says we don't have any real evidence of multiple killers because we have you know, all of our samples point to the same guy.
Right, right. Oh, wow. Just what a, I'm thinking again about just what a horrifying situation it is.
Just the unknown that they've just, Hart was acquitted and these families have just been left wondering, was it him? And if it was him, you know, they kind of feel like they didn't get justice, but at the same time, he did go back to prison and then he died 3 months later. So just such mixed feelings from them on whether they could rest easy.
This is a mess all over it. It's just all this very frustrated. I get a vibe of people very sad and frustrated and, you know, longing for closure, which is obviously what they're doing. But it's just.
Yeah. And you can feel how painful it was for the families to, because normally if you had, you know, these three little girls get killed, you know, you would have everyone in the community shouting off with his head.
Right. And you got him here supporting the guy.
To have them all having chicken dinners to raise money for his defense fund, you know, it was just very painful for them. Sheriff Mike Reed said, quote, "Unless something new comes up, something brought to light that we are not aware of, I am convinced where I'm sitting of Hart's guilt and involvement in this case."
It's just, God, I just can't even imagine what it would be like to be, you know, to be a police officer, to be a good police officer, trying to solve this and having an unsolved case like this just eat at you.
It's very haunting.
Yeah. Haunting. Never solved. Mm-hmm. Just everything you'd ever be afraid of. Like, this is total boogeyman sort of.
And the poor camp counselor, you know, who discovered the bodies and everything. I mean, she carries so much trauma from that to this day. I was reading, there's a great website. Let me give a shout out to this website. Both of the documentaries, again, are worth watching. Keeper of the Ashes on Hulu and Someone Cry for the Children, which you can find on YouTube. And then there's a website, girlscoutmurders.com.
Yes, I've seen it. It's brilliant. It's amazing.
So good.
So much good stuff.
Yes.
Well, what I liked about it, well, just the one thing I thought was kind of neat about it is it seems like it's been there for a while. It's an amateur site. You know, this is just a group of people, I'm assuming local to some extent, who care about the situation, and they're putting their own personal time and effort. And you can tell while you're scrolling through it that it's been up there for a while. But I can also tell that whoever put it up there really spent a long time doing it, and they did it because they cared about it.
Yeah. They've got lots of original articles, and yeah, it's really good. But anyhow, from a defense perspective, I just thought this one was good because we've talked about, you know, someone on Facebook saying, "I don't think I could defend somebody who hurt little children."
Right.
And I absolutely understand that. I don't know that I could, but if somebody who didn't hurt little children was accused of it because the community and the authorities felt like they needed to find someone fast and they had, you know, a likely suspect and no evidence, then it's so important that that person has a good defense and doesn't get railroaded into a conviction that they don't deserve.
Absolutely. And anybody who doesn't understand that is literally just not thinking clearly, or they're thinking with emotions. But I think we know that we have to have that.
This guy got acquitted, and there is evidence that he was involved. And he died shortly thereafter. And it's just, I think that's another reason that it's so haunting, is that it's just, it was so sort of unsatisfying how it all kind of wound up.
You know, I'll just take the one aspect of this case, which is he was acquitted, found not guilty. And then later there's evidence that comes out to indicate that he may very well be guilty. So let's take it another level. Let's say that there's evidence that came back and the evidence shows, hey, the guy that was found not guilty, hey, he actually did it.
DNA guilty. Match, right?
And then they come back to me as a defense attorney and they're like, well, how do you feel now? And, you know, that's an interesting, that would be a very interesting question, because I wouldn't feel a whole lot different than I'd feel if I had him found not guilty, knowing that he was guilty, because I've done that.
Yeah. You said the prosecution did not make their case, but I know where you're coming from. It's like, okay, so do you feel bad that this person was acquitted and now you know for sure that they were guilty? Well, no, I don't feel bad, because based on the evidence available at the time of the trial, the prosecution did not meet its burden. Had we had DNA evidence, had we had DNA testing at that time, the prosecution could have made its burden. But as it stands, they did not. So no, I don't feel bad about that. I am happy that there are advancements in our technology and that we can find evidence now that we didn't used to have, but you can't convict and incarcerate somebody without enough evidence.
Yeah, you have to prove they're there. And I love the new evidence. I love it when science finds that somebody's innocent. But I love it when science finds who the murderer is. I want the bad guy found. I want the bad guy found just as badly as anybody does.
Right.
You know, but I, I decided a long time ago what job I want to do in the legal field, and it's criminal defense. And it's not because I like defendants. It's not because I like crime. It's against, because I recognize the fact that in order to defend the good people, the only way I can learn to do that and to get good at my job is to defend the bad people.
Mm-hmm.
The only way to do it is to defend everybody, and I'm happy to do it. And I don't have to re-justify it every time I get a bad case. Oh wow, how do I do this? Oh well, Tom, you do this because you believe in defense. I don't have to tell myself that. I mean, I believe it in my soul.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody deserves a good defense, and even to come back later and find out that, you know, you set the guilty guy free. I don't want that to happen. But I don't make any kind of apologies for it. And I don't think any decent defense attorney would. And I don't think anybody out there listening would really think that anybody should apologize for it. If you're really thinking about, you know, how important both sides of the system are, because at the same time, I will say, you know, I appreciate, you know, law enforcement that's out there doing, you know, a good job, because we need you out there.
Okay. So to wrap this up, we forgot to mention last week, but we should mention that we have a Facebook page that people can like.
Yep.
On Facebook, we are Room for Innocence with the number 4. We have a Twitter account, Room for Innocence with the number 4. And we are reachable via email at roomforinnocence4@gmail.com. We are on Spotify, Stitcher, and Apple Podcasts. Yep. And if you enjoy listening to this show and want us to be able to continue, we would be immensely grateful for a 5-star rating and a written review on Apple Podcasts, because that really encourages new people to give the show a chance when they see those positive words.
Absolutely. It definitely helps out a lot.
We are also on Patreon, which is patreon.com. If you want to be a supporter of the show, you can support us for $2 a month. And for $2 a month, we'll give you a shout out on our show and say thank you for your support.
Yeah, for $2 a month, all your dreams will come
true. All your dreams of fame and fortune
every
can
month
come true.
Again and again.
And actually, no, it's one shout out, just one time.
But I want the $2 every month.
And then lastly, we really want to get more reviews on Apple Podcasts. And so we are offering a contest to win a $100 Amazon gift card. And what we were thinking is that we would do, what do you think? $100 for 100 reviews?
I think that sounds fair. So if we can get to 100, it's just what you're thinking. We get to 100 reviews and then we pull a name out of a hat and that person gets $100 somehow. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. We will provide a $100 gift card to one of our first 100 reviewers. And just to make sure that it's clear what that means, when this is an Apple Podcasts, you can rate a certain number of stars, but we don't actually see that. The only thing that we will see is if you provide a written review. So for people who provide written reviews, we are going to have a contest to give away a $100 Amazon gift card. So go give us a review. Tell everybody how much you love the show. If you don't love the show, just email us and tell us what you want to see.
Yeah, if you don't love the show, just be quiet. Just send me an email. If you're going to write a review, it should just be something simple like Tom's amazing, clearly very intelligent. And I love everything Chris, he says.
And Chris is also there.
Yeah.
Cool. So that's it. On that note,
I'm Tom.
And I'm Chris. And the defense rests. Nailed it.